Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio. I always like to say Persistence Radio as well. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're dishing on the Oscars with arguably the best person for that conversation, and we're pairing that with a nice big helping of pie, baking tips, and an unexpected path to culinary success that's both inspiring and surprising. We welcome back the effervescent, very fun media studies scholar Shilpa Dave for our second annual Oscar Roundup. She's our pop culture go-to, whether dishing on Marvel comic heroines, Simpsons characters, or the movies. And we are thrilled to welcome award-winning author and recipe developer Kathy Barrow. She's written the irresistible cookbook Pi Squared, that's Pi Squared, and has a new one out this fall, When Pies Fly, portable pastries from empanadas to strudels, hand pies to knishes. She is a frequent contributor to national publications such as the New York Times, Savour, Southern Living, and many more. And she has the popular column Bring It in the Washington Post's food section. We'll talk all about making fabulous pies with ease and joy, and we'll talk about the unique recipe she followed leading to her success. And now my success in having this great friend, Nancy. Speaking of, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I feel like we're both, in lieu of what you're saying, perhaps we're both thrilled, I don't want to speak for you, thrilled to be nominated as co-hosts in a supporting radio show. Today only.
Yes.
Can't
yes.
wait for tomorrow. What are you wearing?
Well,
don't tell me.
I have to say, it's more about what I'm eating right now, because Kathy Barrow brought Yankee Doodle Dandy Sour Cherry Slab Pie, and it made us all, I have to say, just immediately made us all happy.
That would make anyone happy, even just hearing about it.
I mean,
that sounds like something the Oscars should be calling her about for next year, if not.
Yeah.
Good
well,
morning.
Put it this way, I could see why she's award winning. It's fabulous.
Oh, that is excellent. And you know, as I think we were speaking earlier, way earlier, there is something significant not just on Sunday but on Monday as well. Something
What's
significant
that?
For a few. Beautiful hours, as he would say, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will be the top-ranked government official on U.S. soil, because both he and his and the man who has a crush on dictators will be on his way to Vietnam, and Pence, the man who embodies mayonnaise, is going to be down in Colombia, Bogota, Colombia. So she's in charge for a few hours.
May I say, this is, first of all, that was hilarious. I have to say, this is the time to build the wall when they're out of the country. Can we build a wall and then not let them back?
National emergency. Let's ring that out loud and clear. Anyway.
Yes.
So there you go. And also, I know, because you're probably trying to, you know, get in a few more bites of this wonderful pie.
Go ahead.
Right. It's my turn for the event to bring up on March 2nd, next Saturday, from 7 to 11, our good friend, two-time guest of the show, Jaywar. He has orchestrated the 2K19, that second annual Vibe Fest he's the founder of. There's going to be, you guys, Charlottesville will get its groove on next Saturday from 7 to 11. He and his band, Vibe Riot, will be there, but there's a whole evening of cross-cultural music and genres and, most importantly, dancing.
Yes, and
at the Ix Park.
And no one better to support than Jaywar, because he's just a stand-up, amazing guy. as well. So I wanted to mention that you can find Apropos of Something, all 74. This will be 75 shows on Apple Podcasts and my new favorite app, Overcast. And with no further ado, our first guest is Shilpa Dave. She is an assistant professor of media studies and American studies at the University of Virginia and an assistant dean in the College of Arts and Sciences. Shilpa researches and teaches about representations of race and gender in media and popular culture, American cultural narratives of immigration, comparative American studies, including Asian American and South Asian American studies, and film, television, and literary studies. Among her many other publications, she has written Indian Accents, Brown Voice, and Racial Performance in American Television and Film. Today, we're going to talk a lot about the Oscars. It is great to have you back, Shilpa Dave. Welcome.
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you, Nancy. I'm delighted to be back and to talk about what I'll be wearing when I'm watching the Oscars.
What are you wearing?
It'll probably be black.
Okay.
Is there symbolism in that? Is there symbolism? And what is your overall impression of the Oscar nominations this year?
Well, actually, I think the Oscar nominations show a wide diversity of film. We have a lot of different kinds of narratives and types of film this year than any other year. And I think one of the things that I've been talking to actually in my film class is how we're seeing historical films and historical narratives come to light, but also how we're seeing films that represent contemporary moments, as well as also we're seeing really great film crafters too, as well. And so it really brings to a point, what does it mean to win the best, or the Oscar for the best picture? What does it mean to get that nomination and also to win that award? Because I think it's been changing. Is it because a film is reflecting a certain contemporary moment? Is it because a film has a certain effect that becomes a social movement? Is it because a film is wonderfully crafted and, you know, will stand the test of time and something that we can teach in film classes forever? What is it that gives the idea of the best picture? And it's been changing, I think, over the years.
Do you have any hunches which, I know, it's always like, what do you think the Academy's going to do, but also what do you want to do? So I'm never really sure how someone wants to answer that. So please answer it whichever way, you know, whether you what you see or what you think the Academy's going to choose.
Well, I actually
asked... You guys eating pie? What's going on?
Yeah.
Little microphone malfunction. You've heard of...
The pie got in the way. It's delicious.
We're all delirious. It's just like I'm a little happier than normal, and so, you know, less attention to detail.
I asked
my class of about 35 students to pick the best picture nominee. We did an exercise in class, knowing I was coming on the show. And so a shout out to any of those guys who are listening. Hello. And the two main groups in terms of best picture were Black Panther and Roma. And that seems to be the consensus that I'm seeing that the media is playing up. And Roma in particular has swept the award season. And it's a gorgeous film. And it's by a very talented director, Alphonse Cuarón, who has won an Academy Award before. But this one is a black and white film, which is an homage to his growing up in 1970s Mexico City. And he's really talking about his family. And the key characters in this film are his live-in nanny and the mother, and how his family and the events that happen in his personal life come up against what's happening in 1970s Mexico City. And a lot of people have been talking about in terms of what he does with the cinematography, the way that he puts the camera in on different people, and even, you know, the characters that he has. The woman who plays Cleo, the live-in domestic worker, she's actually a first-time actress. He went all over Mexico searching for an actress to play her, and her name is Yalitza Aparicio, and she's been nominated for Best Actress Award, and she's never acted before, and she's just wonderful in this film. So I think a lot of my film students who love the craft of film, and a lot of people who love film we just really enjoy this movie. And then we have on the other side Black Panther, which came out last year at this time. I was talking about it last year, which has created, it's just a social phenomena, but it's also a domestic and worldwide box office hit. It's the number one movie of 2018, domestically and worldwide. And some people are saying, oh, it's a superhero movie. And yes, it is, but I really believe it transcends the genre, because it has affected so many people and really shown us a new vision, or at least a different vision of what we can see in terms of Africa, African Americans, a vision of a different kind of future where the ensemble cast is all Black or African American. And they were recognized by a couple of awards where in the Screen Actors Guild, they won the award for Best Outstanding Cast. And BAFTA, which is the British sort of Academy Awards, they weren't nominated for Best Picture. They won in the one category they were, which was Special Effects. So here the question is, how do we think about a film that is a social phenomena that has affected, that so many people have seen, and that have changed, I think, the way in which we see how we look at diversity, in particular racial diversity, on screen. And looking at Africa and African Americans, it's everything that you would want a film to be. It has tragedy. It has, you know, sort of an epic heroic journey. It has, you know, the tale of origin. It's just really wonderful. And so that probably tells you right there what I feel is that I would love Black Panther to win because of the way it hits me emotionally. But I do think Roma is the one that's probably going to get it. And it'll be historical and wonderful on different parts because that would be the first non-English film or foreign language film to win Best Picture.
Oh, wow. That's pretty big. Do you think that we're at a moment now that will last as far as the diversity and some of these great firsts that you've been talking about?
Well, I think what this year has shown with Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther being two of the most successful films is that diversity is profitable. And oftentimes the studios used to say, or producers used to say, well, who are going to go see those films? Maybe the mainstream majority audiences in the U.S. won't like those films. Or if we are taking those films overseas, overseas people want to see people in America. They don't want to see films about, race relations in the United States. They want to see ones that will transfer well. And that argument no longer flies because of these two really wonderful films that did very different things. And so I guess what we need to think about is, yes, diversity is profitable, but the studios still are not being inclusive. We still have issues with differences in terms of casting, in terms of writing, directors. We've had more women in particular and women leads than we've ever had before. But we also need to see more directors and writers, and as well as actors and actresses being in front of the camera and seeing that representation of these different types of stories. And so one of the snubs that people have been talking about is, where is Crazy Rich Asians in the Oscars? And even though it was a box office hit, maybe or maybe not for Best Picture, but I don't know why it's not there for Best Cinematography. That film was gorgeous. It was it was just beautifully shot, or costuming, or the way in which we saw Singapore. I think really, really was wonderful. So what happened to that? Why wasn't that? Why is it sort of an Oscar snub?
Well, I was going to ask you that actually earlier. Yeah, similarly, well, I guess we have yet to hear about Sunday, obviously, but similarly, Crazy Rich Asians won like a Screen Actors Guild, they got a Producers Guild, they got, which is an equivalent to a Best Picture nomination, and as you're already alluding, the Oscars completely snubbed it. I was definitely wondering what you thought about that.
I don't know. I think that when we're thinking about diversity, especially in an American context, it's usually this black-white racial dynamic. And I think when you start bringing in brown, or you start bringing in, you know, Asian, the idea is how can we think about diversity in different ways? I think the other snub was I thought that, you know, that Michelle Yeoh should have gotten a Best Supporting Actress nominee, because I thought she was especially wonderful as the mother in that film. I think that when we see the directors and the best directors, we have Alphonse Cuarón and we have Spike Lee, who finally got a director's nod after a very, very long time. I mean, the last time we were hoping to see him was 1990 for Do the Right Thing. And I think the snub of that, where that picture did not get nominated and then Driving Miss Daisy won, is, you know, it resonates. And even though he got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Oscars, I think he's really, I hope he's very happy, because this time the Oscars are recognizing him, where he did get not only a best, you know, he got a best adapted screenplay, he got a best director nod. And so I think he's really hoping. He's the dark horse, I think, for best director. Mm-hmm. A lot of the awards have, you know, awarded it already to Alphonse Cuarón. But Spike Lee could sneak in there. Yeah. And so I think that's an interesting one. But again, a lot of these, the directors, again, are all men. So where are the women? And the screenwriters, too, as well. So we have made strides in different ways in terms of reflecting different kinds of opinions. But the studio heads, the studios are still pushing forward certain kinds of films.
So there's some controversy around Green Book. Can you talk about that? What your opinion is about the movie?
What controversy are you alluding to?
Nancy?
The history of its... the fact that the screenwriter is Tony's son, and they apparently, you know, really didn't at all seek out the family, the Shirley family, for any of the, you know, the research. And I think even Marshall Ali didn't even know he could speak to them and get some insight into his character.
Yeah. I thought that Green Book was a very good kind of buddy film, but a lot of people are talking about it in relationship to Driving Miss Daisy. So that the way in which it was shown was it was a feel-good narrative, and the acting was wonderful. I thought the acting was really great, but the fact that, again, certain people are allowed to tell their side of the story, and we're not, and this is a historical story that's based on a true story, and yet if they weren't able to even talk to the Shirley family, that seems to be leaving out a big part of the story.
Right.
Right. And all, I think it was like an all-white creative team, as you said, like a classic whitewashing Driving Miss Daisy sort of point of view. Even though the acting is obviously award-worthy, but the direction that it took from the beginning was, you know, just marginalizing the man whose story it is.
Yes, yes. And so it very much fits in that line. You know,
right.
I just taught the 1967 film In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger, which is set in 1967. And it's another one of those films on race relations. But I think that film is so much better than Green Book, because I think that what it does is it really shows what was happening in the moment and now. And so when you think about films that stand the test of time, that film travels really, really well, because it's a very, very emotional, but also I think wonderful depiction of the ways in which race relations is very difficult. And this was in 1967.
We're going to go to a break right now. We'll be right back with Shilpa Dave, and in about 10 or 15 minutes, Kathy Barrow. She's going to talk all about pies. We'll be back with much more on the Oscars after this. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're here with Shilpa Dave. She's a professor at the University of Virginia. So speaking of shows and ratings and awards, why do you think the TV show itself, the ratings are going down and people are watching it less frequently?
A lot of the network and the show itself is worried that people are tuning out, and ratings have consistently been going down. Last year, it was the lowest ratings ever for an Oscar show. And so one of the things that the television show tried to do was to say, okay, we are going to cut it down so that it doesn't go over a certain amount of time. We want to make sure it's in this three-hour time period, because I think that people think it's too long, that the speeches go on forever, and it gets really boring. So the Academy said, okay, in order to cut down the time period, we're going to take out a couple of awards, and we're not going to talk about them live. We'll do them during commercial breaks. So we'll give the awards for live action short, cinematography, editing, and makeup, and hair online. It'll be streaming online, but we won't show those they'll be done during commercial breaks. And there was a huge uproar from a lot of the members, including a lot of the directors, because the idea is, you know, what the network and what the shows think people want to see is that, in particular, that...
Let's take this opportunity to fix your mic. Will you just turn it towards you? I hear a phone.
Okay.
This is a live program, and we are proud of it.
It's the Academy. They don't want you bringing up the commercial faux pas they were going with. No, kidding.
So one of the directors, Alphonse Cuarón, said, you know, you can make a film without actors. You can make a film without sound, but you have to have cinematography. How can you actually not have, the look of the film be a part and part of filmmaking? And so there was a huge uproar. So then the Academy said, oh, okay, we will give these films. And the same thing with makeup and hair. So one of the things that the film industry did was it really came up and said, listen, these kinds of films that we make, to make a good film, it takes a lot of people to create a best picture, or even any kind of picture. And so it was really the industry sort of saying, this is our craft, and this is our show about recognizing the people in our craft, even the people you don't see. And so I thought that was actually really great. And so then to offset that, and then what the Oscars are doing, instead of having people just do thank you speeches, they're putting in more music. And I think that's what makes, you know, why people like to watch the Grammys more, is because there's more performance. So we're going to get Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper performing for the first time together, and they're going to be singing Shallow from A Star Is Born. And that's a lot now of what we see being touted, who's going to sing and who's going to perform, as opposed to just the thank you speeches.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of things, sorry, Ellen.
You can go ahead, but I was just going to say, it once again, speaks to our short attention span. You know, go ahead, Nancy.
As I step all over you. What? No.
And I was going to say the other thing, Nancy, you pointed it out.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Nancy, you pointed it out at the very beginning, is why do people tune in? They tune in for fashion, and they tune in for the clothes. And I do that too as well.
And they attend for the food.
So how ironic. They were going to put, you know, speaking out of both sides of their mouth, they're going to put costume design and hair and makeup, you know, during a commercial. Shame on them.
I know. And there was, you know, I've been to there was this great exhibit at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts a couple of years ago, which was about the costumes in iconic films. And it was one of the best exhibits I ever saw. So they had all the costumes from all these Meryl Streep films, from, you know, Out of Africa to Sophie's Choice to some of her others. And they just had the costumes. And the idea was they make the character. And they had like the great costume from, they had Indiana Jones, like the, you know, the bullwhip and the leather jacket and the hat. And so it's another way to think about why we have iconic characters. I mean, how could you have a movie without like the fashion and the production design, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. Cinematography. I mean, geez, I think they should get their award during the broadcast, for crying out loud.
So what happened is the Academy, you know, the pushback on that was such that the awards are now being shown live.
Right. And what did you think for a brief time? It may come back next year, but there was talk that they were going to create that new category, something like Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film, like to take so that something that was the superhero action movie, you know, they could get like the Sirius Award, I guess, and the other, you know, like, anyway, what did you think of that possibility?
Yeah, I think there was also a lot of pushback against that one, too. And I actually don't think there should be, you know, an award for like the best popular moneymaker versus another kind of film. I think film should stand on its own. And just because something makes a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean it should win an award. By the same token, the idea is it goes back to those questions I was asking at the beginning. What does best picture mean? So I think that separating them out is also separating the entertainment part of film from the art part of film and creating this dichotomy, which has been there always. But by putting them in one category, the idea is that, you know, we see the variety of film. And again, what does best picture mean? How does film hit us emotionally? How does it reflect the social context of the times that we're in, or a historical time, too, as well? You know, what is it about the best pictures? What do we love about film that makes something a best picture as opposed to a film that we just plunk down our money for? Mm-hmm. And I think with the popular films, if you look at this year in like 2018, you know, the top 12 films were all superhero or were other kinds of films, you know, superhero action adventure films. And so those do make a lot of the money.
What do you think of the third remake of A Star is Born, and does it say anything about where we are now as far as the other films in comparison?
Well, I think that what we're looking at with the remake of Star is Born is I thought it was a really good film, and the songs are great, the soundtrack's great. A lot of people particularly love Lady Gaga in her role, and I think she did a great job. But I thought it was a good film, but, you know, I'm actually a big fan of the Judy Garland version. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to do a remake, how is this different? I was thinking, why didn't they switch around the genders and have an older woman and a younger man? Or why didn't they do like maybe an interracial relationship or something like that, that you could do something different? Because this is 2018, right? And so that story is one that's been told actually three times before. And so what was it doing that was different? And that to me is my main thing, is like, I want to see people play with the idea of a story and recast it in different ways. And I didn't see that happening in that film.
I think they opted for box office in this case.
And it did. And it got a big box office draw. And it was a really good film. I enjoyed it. But it didn't do anything new for me.
Are there any, or more than one, are there any categories that you are, you know, watching closely that you really hope go to a certain person or film, for that matter?
Yeah, well, I think for Best Actor, Rami Malek has been getting a lot of awards for Freddie Mercury. And so I'm actually very, I thought he was fabulous.
Yeah,
and I actually... And I loved the movie. There are some scholars who say, you know, it wasn't as accurate, that that there were some issues with the music and how it was produced. But everyone I've talked to, especially with the last 20 minutes of that movie when they were showing the live age footage, for those of us who lived through that, it was amazing. I mean, I wanted to get up in the theater and, like, you know, rock with him. And it was just a wonderful movie. And I think that moment in particular really, really caught me. And I thought he just really, really worked on that performance and did an excellent job. So I hope he wins. But I did think, I have to give a shout out to Christian Bale for playing Dick Cheney, because I think he did Vice was a tough film because it was such a dark satire, but, and it really reflects sort of some of the political moves that are happening now. But to give, even Christian Bale was joking, I think, when he got his Golden Globe, that he couldn't believe he was getting an award for playing Dick Cheney.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love Bohemian Rhapsody, too, and I'm just all about Queen now. Like, I just can't get enough of Queen. I think there's a little bit of a wave with, I just saw, I don't know if you saw the documentary that apparently wasn't released, all the, because they have so much footage. And it's really great to watch after you've seen the movie, or maybe before. Well, I just wanted to ask you this question before we run out of time about, just to bring it to our current political situation here in Virginia. What do you see? Is there a relationship between blackface stuff going on here and brown voice?
Yeah, I think it's really all of us thinking about racial performance and how there's a history of racial performance that has, you know, been part of American history for a long time in our way in which we think about race relations. And so when we're looking at the idea of people acting or dressing up as another racialized character, the idea is, why are they doing that? And there have been a lot of, you know, great books which have sort of looked at, you know, the idea of blackface, white noise, and Michael Rogan wrote this great book about why is it that men in particular feel this need to act as another racial group. And this goes back even to the first talkie, Al Jolson, when he was doing the jazz singer, actually dressed up in blackface. And it was the idea of, at that time, they were looking at how Jewish Americans could sort of build themselves into the American lexicon and sort of race relations. And that film came out in 1927. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting, and as I said, Michael Rogan and others have talked about this film in that regard, is that you have a character who is struggling with his own identity, which was being Jewish American, and you know, sort of changing traditions in the 1920s, and then how does he become American? He's able to put on blackface and insert himself into the American American ideals of what is of American identity. And then in blackface, there's a scene where he talks to his girlfriend, who is dressed as in a showgirl outfit, and that's Mary Dale, who is Irish American. So what you're seeing is Al Jolson in blackface, having a romantic moment with his girlfriend, who's Irish American, and seeing how people sort of play with this idea of you know, race relations. So what does that mean in terms of thinking about this in modern times? This is something that not only Virginia, but I think the whole country has been doing. I mean, when I was in college, people were doing all different kinds of things with, you know, different kinds of parties where people were dressing up. The question is, if you're going to dress up as another person or even as a celebrity, do you have to change the color of your skin? Are there other racialized tropes that you use to indicate that? And so what I talk about in my book about brown voice is that that race and racialization is not just visual. It also includes other kinds of and it includes accent, the way someone talks, but it also includes, you know, the way we think about people dressing too. And so that's where costuming, makeup, and all of that, they create a racialized portrait. And so if we learn about the history of where this came from, I think people will understand that just because something's funny doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have a historical context. And it might be funny to you, but it's definitely not funny to somebody else.
Well, thank you so much, Shilpa Dave, Assistant Professor of Media Studies and American Studies at the University of Virginia and an Assistant Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences. I hope next year you'll be back.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Nancy. And thanks for the pie, too.
Yes. Thanks. Thanks to Kathy, our next guest. But before that, Nancy, do you have a news of note for us?
I'll be very short. I do. Speaking of people that are not white, the White House, ironically, their latest iteration to crack down undocumented immigration happened last Wednesday when the Department of Homeland Security is now going proposing a ban on employment for the spouses of H-1B visa holders. The H-1B visa holders are typically they're highly skilled immigrants, many of whom work in tech industries and academia, research, nonprofits, and now their spouses who come over with them that are allowed to live here will not be allowed to work here.
Wow.
And so they're obviously not only bringing in income, but it's another way. It's like 100,000 people that are affected by this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll stop there because I know we're running.
Yeah, running a little short. I just wanted to mention some good news in North. Well, it's good and bad, but it's good as a result of bad. North Carolina on Thursday ordered a new election in the 9th congressional district after the Republican candidate was confronted by tons of evidence that he had. Illegal voter count, turnout, an effort, the way he counted the votes was illegal, and many other things. So there's going to be a new election, which I'm thrilled to hear about, and that was my news of note. So without further ado, we have the pie maker and writer extraordinaire. She buttered us up with a butter crust. pause for laughter while I get my notes. So she is author of Pie Squared, Irresistibly Easy, Sweet, and Savory Slab Pies. And her new book out in the fall is When Pies Fly, Portable Pastries from Empanadas to Strudels, Hand Pies to Knishes. She's a frequent contributor to The New York Times, Savour, Southern Living, NPR. And she writes a regular and very popular column in the Washington Post food section called Bring It. And we are going to talk about pies. We're going to talk about...
And you know what, Ellen?
What's that?
She brought it.
She brought it. She
brought
did
it
bring it. You're
Come
absolutely
on.
Right. Very astute.
I apologize.
It's okay. Anyway, so welcome to the show, Kathy Barrow.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
Yeah, so Pie Squared is all about slab pies. So tell us, for the uninitiated, what is a slab pie?
Rather than a round pie, which is sort of traditional,
yes.
I like a slab pie. It's rectangular. It's made in a baking sheet. It's a lot easier to serve and eat. It serves more people. And you never have that time when you're cutting a slice of a round pie and the filling falls out from the left. And you wonder, does that filling go with this slice or with the other slice? There's none of that problem. So that's what a slab pie is.
And how did you come to, I know you had written a book prior to that, but how did you come to turn your love of slab pies into this cookbook?
Well, it's a little embarrassing. I write this column for the Post called Bring It, and the first iteration, my editor, Bonnie Benwick, asked me to make a slab pie, and I'd never made one before, but she knew that I had a pie reputation. She gave me my first blue ribbon for a sour cherry pie back in 2009. So she asked me to make a slab pie, and I did, and it really made a hit. It actually was the most popular recipe in the whole Washington Post food section for the year. But that night, the night that it went online, it really hit a lot of people. And Bonnie called me the next day and said, "This was amazing." And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then I just went on doing other things. But I mentioned the success to a few friends, and one of whom was speaking to her literary agent, who said, "I think there should be a book on slab pies." And so Marilyn told her agent Lori to call me, and within 3 days, I was on my way to writing a proposal, and a couple of months later, I had a book deal.
Well, we're going to come back with much more about these pies after this hard break. We'll be right back. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone, to Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Kathy Barrow. Right now we're talking about Pie Squared, about slab pies. So it's such a great book. The photography is amazing. You have amazing resources about all the equipment and everything. And the recipes are both sweet and savory. So you've got the Reuben with rye crust, which it looks like it would be one of my favorite. And
that
also
is so good.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you just want to pull a chair up to the pie.
And you also have something called, we have a lot of sweet pies. No campfire necessary. S'mores pie.
Yes, five ingredients.
It's
about the easiest thing you can make.
So, and I just got a note from the previous host who messengered it in. It says, "This is the best pie I've ever eaten. Thank you." So we're happy. Yeah, it really. I turned to Kathy after I took a bite, and I was like, "It makes pie makes you happy."
I think that's true. I think that pie builds community. It makes people happy. It's just a great food. And it's also got such history, if you think about it. People have been wrapping things in pastry forever. It makes it portable. It extends leftovers. You can make a slab pie and eat it for lunch for the week. There are a lot of reasons to eat pie.
And, you know, to Ellen's point about people's response, another response I have read about your work is, you push the envelope, you're thinking outside the crust or pushing the buttery, crusty envelope, whatever. What are some innovations in this comfort food that you bring to the book?
Well, I'm really proud of the crust chapter. There are 15 different crusts offered. 7 of them are rolled out and 8 are pressed in. And I tried to make sure that every pie had substitutions available so that if you really are dough phobic, if you are unable to pick up a rolling pin without having an anxiety attack, then you can press in a cracker crust or an olive oil crust or a cookie crust and still have pie. So within the rolled out crusts, however, once you overcome your fear with my instructions, which make people into pie makers, truly, I have a cheddar cheese crust that's really delicious, but also a caramelized onion crust that I think just puts some of the savory pies over the top. There's a cheesy cauliflower rarebit pie with a caramelized onion crust, and you really can't beat that for a vegetarian offering.
And, you know, Kathy, I know I was curious how this book came to be, but I'm also curious, what is your cooking background? Was baking always your goal?
I've been cooking forever. I had my first dinner party when I was about 14. I think I like entertaining and cooking, being in the kitchen. It's a very creative outlet for me, but I never thought it would be my career. That was an accident. And it had to do with that sour cherry pie that Bonnie Benwick gave me a blue ribbon for. Before that, I was a landscape designer. And before that, I was a marketing person in a nonprofit in D.C. So now I'm an author, and I'm not quite sure how all that happened, but I feel very fortunate.
And do you feel there's no occasion that a pie cannot be the answer for?
There is absolutely no occasion.
Okay. So we talk about the Oscars. So here's my question. What would you bring to an Oscar? What kind of pie is appropriate for an Oscar party?
Well, I think that because the Oscars are late, I would probably do a sweet pie. And my favorite for an evening event with adults is the chocolate crusted bittersweet chocolate Pop-Tart. And
wow.
It's just sensational.
There are some pictures that look like Pop-Tarts. You have a strawberry frosted pie.
Yes, that would be the other one because it's so adorable. It's got confetti sprinkles all over it, and yeah, it's really fun.
I have to give a little shout out to your writing ability as well. I just want to quote from your column, Bring It, from the Washington Post. It's about the filled sweet buns, the kolache, which originates from Eastern Europe. And as you say, it has relatives in Texas. So you write, I realize that baking with yeast is time-consuming and a challenge for some, but the payoff is handsome. Yeast comes to life with sugar and flour, warmth and time, yielding bounce and lift. It's quite glorious to be so courageous. Kolaches taste best when they are fresh.
Thank you.
Yeah. Delightful.
So what is the way that your kitchen space, how does one that's so faux pie obsessed, what are the essentials in your kitchen to make a pie?
Well, I count on the food processor for all of my rolled out pie crusts. It's very fast. It cuts in the butter really easily. You don't have to worry about overworking the dough. So the food processor is important. A good rolling pin, and that's a personal thing. I have several, but I've come to really love this giant, heavy silicone rolling pin with handles for rolling out pie crust. I have something called a baking steel. Bread bakers and pie bakers, or pizza makers, know about this. It's the newest iteration of a pizza stone, and it's a solid piece of steel. It weighs about 15 pounds, and that sits in my oven and heats up while I'm preparing the pie. And when I bake it, I bake the pie on top of this hot steel in a baking sheet, and the heat underneath means that the bottom crust remains really crispy. So I think those three things are all you need to make a pie.
So you write in the dedication to Pie Square, you dedicated it to your mother.
I did.
Yeah. So, and you said she taught you everything about pie. How did she influence your baking?
I have this wonderful memory of her, and she really was not a baker. I think pie making is different than baking. Baking requires such precision, and pie making can be a little looser. But I have this image of her on Thanksgiving morning. She would get up, and she would have made the pie dough ahead of time. And she'd have about 5 discs of dough wrapped in wax paper on the counter. She'd pour a cup of coffee and light a cigarette, because that was then.
Right.
And then she would roll out like pie after pie after pie. And the first thing Thanksgiving, all the pies went in the oven. There'd be apple and mince. She would have frozen sour cherries, so we would have that. Sometimes there'd be pumpkin. I mean, she'd make just wonderful pies. So I think that memory has stayed with me. And I have to say that I struggled. Her pies were sensational and simple, and she did it without breaking a sweat. And until I was about 30, I was completely unable to make a pie crust. I was like, they were the worst pies I'd ever tasted, tough and horrible. And then I suddenly had a revelation. And that's, I don't know what it was, but I became a pie maker. And what I can say is that pie making is not a skill. You're not born with it. It's not a talent. It is a skill. And you can learn it just like anything. You just do it over and over, and you become good at it. It's not a talent.
Well, that's refreshing to know for people.
And the recipes that you included in the book, was that a how did you arrive at the ones that made it into the book?
I was just trying to look for good balance and make sure that I represented everything from, you know, beef to chicken and lamb, and also a whole host of vegetarian options, fruit pies, custard pies, cream pies, chocolate pies, nuts. I think that's the way you work up a recipe list.
So talk about that upcoming book. I believe September is the release
date
of that. It's called When Pies Fly,
mm-hmm.
And it talks about, well, it's portable pastries from empanadas to strudels, hand pies to knishes.
Yes. When Pies Fly was a sort of natural movement from Pie Squared, where I was making all these large pies. I'm a household of 2, and that was a lot of pie. I made 193 on the way to Pie Squared.
Wow.
I did count. And I had fortunately just moved into a condo, so all my neighbors ate those pies. But it occurred to me that all of the leftover pie dough and the bits and pieces of fillings and so on, I would make hand pies or galettes or tarts to use up what I had in the refrigerator. And so this next book covers all of those smaller portable pies, but also pies that don't require any kind of pan, like a galette, which is just a round circle of dough into which you put your filling, and then you pull the sides up and pleat them. It's really pretty. And then I moved toward international, and that was, I think, the most exciting part for me, was to explore all the ways that other cultures wrap fillings in dough. And that led me to strudel and stromboli, tarts from France, of course, empanadas. There are, I think, 14 different types of empanadas made in the Southern Hemisphere. Sandra Gutierrez has a great book on them. So I did an empanada chapter, collage, knishes, the little wonderful deli snacks that we've come to think of as belly bombs, but if you make them at home, they're really light and lovely.
Mm.
And then a whole section on fried pies. And if anybody's ever driven through the South and pulled into just the right gas station and picked up fried apple pie, it took me a long time, but I figured out how to make those too.
Sounds wonderful.
I was wondering, actually, Kathy, do you do any traveling, especially for this book or any of your books? Do you do any traveling for inspiration or research?
Not specifically for the books, but I travel quite a bit, and I'm always inspired by what I eat and see and learn everywhere.
What is something that you're thinking about that you haven't innovated quite yet?
Well, I've been playing with Jewish baking quite a bit, and I've got a number of my grandmother's recipes, and I'm trying to simplify them and make them a little bit more home-cook friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like hamantaschen?
Hamantaschen, of course. I have a great rugola recipe. That one's bomb-proof. But I think more rye breads, challahs, apple cakes. Mm-hmm. I do have a Passover pie in the Pie Squared book that I'm pretty proud of. It uses a matzah crust and all coconut milk and cream to make a coconut cream pie with a salty matzah base. It's delicious. And the first line of the head note is, "I can't wait for Passover dessert," said nobody
anytime. Right, exactly. Well, if anyone's going to do it, you're going to do it. There's also a sugar-free fig
there is.
Kind of pie, which looks, the pictures look amazing.
It's very like a fig Newton. It's really, but with a more flaky crust. Mm-hmm.
When you take this book, look, on the road, when you're doing a book tour, you do these pie events. And what happens at those for those that show up at a pie event of yours?
Well, I do demos, and I do hands-on classes. And I'll be doing a demonstration at the Virginia Festival of the Book, by the way. And I will usually demonstrate how to make dough, because it's so easy, how to roll it out. And then how I love to demonstrate how to make a lattice crust, because people are so freaked out by lattice work, and I have come up with the perfect solution. It's called the lazy lattice, and I absolutely dare you to not basket weave your lattice crust and then tell me if somebody doesn't want to eat your pie because of it.
So what else freaks people out that you have simplified?
Well, definitely dough making. When I suggest to people when they're rolling out the dough to put painter's tape on the counter to mark off the size that you're going to so that you know where you're headed instead of just blindly trying to roll it, lift it up, put it over the pan, it doesn't fit, lift it down. Put tape down so you have a guide. I think there are a lot of tips all through the book.
Yeah, there are a lot of tips for sure.
And your membership in the Pie for Breakfast Club, what is
it? Oh, I'm all about pie for breakfast, savory or sweet. Really, I love pie for breakfast.
Well, I can vouch for that. I have this,
mention
the name. Yeah, I have this breakfast bar that I eat kind of constantly, and it's called Cherry Pie. And then Kathy Barrow, I can't say it enough, brought in this Yankee Doodle Dandy sour cherry slab pie, and... No comparison, I should say. So, I mean, pie for breakfast, any kind of pie, does not have to be savory.
No, right? It can be any kind.
I mean,
right.
It was delicious. Well, I think, you know, our culture with pastries, that you probably don't have to convince people of that. But
in the next book, I have a breakfast hand pie that's really wonderful. And you can make them all ahead of time and have them in the freezer, heat it up in the toaster oven. It's got scrambled eggs and sausage and egg and cheese, and it's in a nice butter pastry. It's mm-hmm. delicious.
So where, aside from the book events, you're on social media, where do you want people to find your handiwork?
Well, they can definitely find me on Instagram, and I'm also on Facebook. Those are probably where I spend most of my time. I have a casual relationship with Pinterest, and you'll never find me on Snapchat. How's that?
Fair enough. Well, I think... wherever you're going tomorrow have you ever had to bake a pie for someone that says I only like cake? Is there a pie for that, for people who insist they only
yes,
like cake?
Yes, I have a friend who said to me, I don't like warm fruit, I hate pie. And I thought, how many other kinds of pie have you tried? So I have convinced him, usually with chocolate nuts. You know, my chocolate peanut butter pie is pretty delicious, and that'll move anybody into the pie camp.
There you go. Problem solved.
There's a pie for everything.
I don't doubt it, actually, anymore.
Nancy, I'm really sorry you're not here.
I know.
Pie left over.
I know. We'll have to ship it. Does pie ship well?
Not very well.
Not very.
I do have a funny story to tell. I was asked to bring pie to my publishers for a sales meeting, and I had to make 12 of them. And it involved finding luggage that I could stack pie pans with lids, and it was two pieces of luggage with wheels so that I could wheel them through the Amtrak station and out at Penn Station and up onto the street and down a few blocks to the publishing house, and they made it safely.
You know what I realized is that I sort of teased at the beginning about your career. Just tell us briefly about the trajectory of your career. What got you here, and what did you do before?
I was a serial careerist. This is my my line. I started early in retail. I opened a fish market in my 20s that failed spectacularly but had a great name, Porgy and Bass. Then I went into marketing and tried to have a straight career, but it just didn't really fit. And I left and went to graduate school in landscape design. And my company, my little landscape design company, went the way of so many others in 2008, and that was when I started writing.
Okay, so you've been doing this career for at least 10 years.
10 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're not a newbie, really. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Kathy
Barrow. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. I know you drove in the rain from far places.
I didn't. My husband did.
Your husband. You have a nice partner,
I'm sure.
Yeah, so thank you so much for being here. Award-winning author, recipe developer, Kathy Barrow. Go out and buy Pie Squared and then the new book, When Pies Fly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, come back with that book. I would love some more pie. And whatever you bring, we'll be eating it. So, Nance, do you have a palate cleanser?
I do. I don't. I'm looking at the clock, though.
Well, you only... I don't know. Yeah, you could do it. Yeah, let's do it. Let me play you in, okay?
Okay.
Are you ready? This is the palate cleanser. It's been so long, right? We haven't had time to do one.
It has been a while, yes.
I wanted to try to get this in.
We have not cleansed a palate in weeks.
So you go for it.
Okay. I just want to say, in lieu of the Oscars, let's start with this, that Dustin Hoffman was right. The future is plastics. Specifically, there's a 3D printer that makes pancakes. Not pies yet. It makes pancakes. It lets you design any shape pancake your brunch soul desires. An astronaut, the Eiffel Tower, articles of impeachment, whatever you want. You use this software. You trace the image off your computer, which means you can control which areas get darker and lighter. So the whole thing is in your computer. Then you upload it to this 3D bot printer. You pour the batter into a bottle, and you watch your creation appear because this bot also has a griddle included. So the whole thing is right in front of your eyes. You can add different colors, and, of course, as far as what it costs, speaking of pancakes, it's a stack of $300 bills.
Wow.
It costs $300 for this thing.
Wow. Well,
that's what I got. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to mention that next week we have Adam Nemeth, supposedly an incredibly funny, cool author whose latest book is We Can Save Us All. And I believe Brian Noy is he also a cook?
A baker.
He's a baker.
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Cookbook. Yes.
That's just coincidental.
Red Cross Bakery.
Yes, it's coincidental. And also
coincidental. Good one, Ellen. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean? And also, just a little shout out for our March 23rd show. We're going to have four authors. We're kind of bumping the next show after us, and we're going to take up 2 hours to talk to four different authors.
Supersizing.
Yeah, supersizing on March 23rd. Our music is by Springtide. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Special shout out to Shilpa Dave for coming back the second year to talk about the Oscars, and Kathy Barrow. A wonderful, wonderful author who we hope we've won her over. She's won us over. Please come back next year. Thanks, everybody. And thank you, Nancy.
Yeah, sure. You too.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.